We're looking in Nagorno-Karabakh at a dispute that dates back 100 years, but historically both the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis, for much longer than that, have regarded this territory, Karabakh, as a very important and special place for their culture and for their people. We're talking about a Armenian-majority territory, a very fertile, beautiful territory, economically quite successful territory, with an Armenian majority, which has a long cultural tradition of Armenian heritage, but which is also located very firmly inside the geographical and economic space of Azerbaijan, and also has a Azeri minority who have lived there for many centuries, and one town, which was a very important town, Shusha, for the Azeris and for Azerbaijan. So a place which has strong meaning and strong claims for two peoples. If we come to the 20th century and the era in which empires were coming to an end and nation states were beginning to form, we saw the Armenian and the Azerbaijani nations fighting for control of Karabakh at the beginning of the 20th century, before and after the October Revolution. Then, obviously, the Soviet Union was formed in 1920-21. Azerbaijan and Armenia both became parts of the Soviet Union. And in 1921, the decision was made to give this territory some degree of autonomy, but to locate it within Azerbaijan. So you had an Armenian-majority autonomous territory inside Azerbaijan, with Armenia literally only a few miles away. So you had an inherently unstable situation with people inside Azerbaijan but looking just over the border to Armenia. And in the Soviet period you also had lots of disputes in which the Armenians of Karabakh wanted more autonomy, more rights, more contact with Armenia, and the Azerbaijanis didn't want to give it to them. So a lot of tension within the Soviet era, within the communist era, but obviously because we're talking about a totalitarian state, that was suppressed, that didn't get much beyond the surface. But as soon as the 1985 coming to power of Mikhail Gorbachev brought a thaw in the Soviet Union, this problem began to creep up the agenda again, and in 1988 we saw the Armenians appealing directly to Moscow for this territory to be transferred from Azerbaijan to Armenia within the Soviet Union. And we saw in February 1988 lots of things happening. The first strike in the Soviet Union for generations, the first mass street protest in both Armenia and Azerbaijan, the first time that Communist Party officials were defying the center in Moscow, the first violence, first pogroms, with Armenians being killed on the streets of Azerbaijan. So all within a matter of a few weeks, this hidden problem came to the surface. And I think one could say, right from the beginning, this was a clash which was irreconcilable. Both communities were living in their own insulated world. Both found it impossible to recognize the rights of the others. Both wanted Karabakh. And the ironic thing being that these were two communities who, on a day-to-day level, actually lived together pretty well. They intermarried, they traded together. But on a political, historical level, both of them could not accept the claim that Nagorno-Karabakh was part of the other. And so the violence escalated. You saw essentially a mini-Soviet civil war, a civil war inside the Soviet Union in 1991. And then with the end of the Soviet Union, at the end of 1991, two new states are formed, Armenia and Azerbaijan. And because of the way the boundaries had been drawn in Soviet times, the international recognized boundary was that this territory, Karabakh, was part of Azerbaijan. This was obviously unacceptable to the Armenians. Weren't happy with this. They wouldn't put up with this. They carried on fighting. And so it turned from a Soviet civil war into a war between two states, with the Armenians, new state of Armenia, backing the secession of the Armenians inside Azerbaijan, and If you add to that all the new heavy weaponry left behind by the Soviet army with the end of the Soviet Union, we suddenly had tanks and artillery and airplanes and lots of unemployed Russian soldiers fighting on both sides, and the whole thing escalated into a massive war. Well, if you talk to anyone on both sides, they both use history, and they start talking about, the Armenians in particular, start talking about 301 AD, and they start looking back into the mist of time. I'm a bit sceptical about the uses of history. I think this is very much a 20th century dispute, and that history is used to legitimize people's claims, which were actually only really articulated in the 20th century. You do end up encountering two universes which exist in parallel and which have nothing in common, and which have no points of intersection. And that's been strengthened by the fact that these two nations, Armenia and Azerbaijan, for more than 10 years, for 15 years, have basically had no contact with one another. They also expelled the population of the other, so all the Armenians were expelled from Azerbaijan, with a very few exceptions, and vice versa. This means that it's absolutely fascinating and quite a schizophrenic experience to research this issue. You spend a lot of time, I spend a lot of time simply travelling between the two places. I could be in one place in Karabakh, and at night you can see the lights of a town 20 or 30 miles away, or even less in some cases, and it would take me 3 or 4 days of hard travel, maybe more than 1,000 kilometers travel, in order to get from A to B, going via Georgia. Sometimes I even flew via Moscow, because that was actually quicker to get from one place to another. And meeting people who have an enormous amount in common, certainly much more in common than they with each other than they do with me, who often remembered each other quite fondly, and yet who now inhabited these two parallel universes where Armenia had one set of views on history and what was happening, the reality of the situation, and the Azerbaijan had another. A lot of myths have grown up about this conflict. I strongly reject the idea that there are some kind of ancient hatreds between the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis, that they're sort of culturally determined to hate each other. There's a lot of intermarriage between them, very good neighbourly relations. So there's nothing culturally determined about a Muslim nation and a Christian nation hating one another. Azerbaijan has very good relations with Georgia, which is a Christian nation, and Armenia has very good relations with Iran, which is an Islamic republic, even though Armenia is 99% Christian. So I reject the idea that there's some kind of ancient hatreds. I think it's very much to do with the kind of structural politics, the geography almost of the region, just the way that these two nations are. They both feel very insecure and incomplete without this territory of Karabakh, and therefore they've constantly been brought into political collisions in both trying to claim it, and that has set two communities against each other and mobilized lots of people fighting for it. And I do think that this is another myth of the Karabakh conflict, that it was manipulated from outside. We're talking about somewhere that was a very obscure provincial place that, back in February 1988, when the Soviet Union was still a very controlled space, trouble broke out. And the trouble broke out on a grassroots level. It involved ordinary people who got very impassioned and started demonstrating and fighting each other. That, to me, is proof that this was not manipulated by the KGB or the CIA or something, or the Iranians or the Turks, that this was a homegrown conflict. Certainly the outside players made things worse rather than better. The Moscow, the Kremlin and the Politburo were very incompetent in the way they dealt with it. But I think that they were always, they lost control. They weren't manipulating it. Everyone has for years been trying to catch up with it, and very large players like the USA and Russia still can't sort out the Karabakh dispute, which suggests to me that its roots are very, very local, and the impediments to it being solved are very much on the ground. This was a very destructive war, and a lot of towns and villages were destroyed by it. You've got, on the land which is occupied by the Karabakh Armenians, particularly Nagorno-Karabakh itself, you've seen a huge amount of reconstruction, and you'll see very little war damage on the Armenian side, apart from in the places which were the Azerbaijani villages. Again, inside Azerbaijan, there are some areas which have been reconstructed. The terrible thing is, because there's this whole zone in the middle, which is occupied by the Armenians, but they say they don't want to hold on to it. They're just keeping it as a buffer zone. They're keeping it to trade away in negotiations. So they accept, basically, that it's part of Azerbaijan. They don't want to keep it. And yet, because of the way things happened, it's now totally leveled to the ground. Basically, you know, it's just bricks and mortar standing there. Anything which was worthwhile, from wires and window panes, and even a lot of bricks, have been taken away. And hundreds of thousands of people lived in these towns and villages, which are now totally destroyed. And this is really the unacceptable side of the conflict, that over a much smaller territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, where only a few thousand people live, these much larger territory has been totally destroyed, and basically half a million people, who everyone knows will go back to their homes under any peace agreement, can't go back because the two sides can't agree on the status of a much smaller area, which is of Nagorno-Karabakh. So this is a really tragic aspect of this dispute, is all these destroyed towns and villages which have just been lying there for more than 10 years now, and people can't return to them. You could say that Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a very small place, it's a tiny territory with a population of probably less than 100,000 people, is a knot that has tied up a far, far bigger region. Not only Armenia and Azerbaijan, which have the longest border in the Caucasus, which has now been closed for 15 years, but Georgia as well, which is the third country in the Caucasus. And then that affects Turkey and Iran. The Turkish-Armenian border has been closed also for all that time because Turkey supports Azerbaijan, and so there's no contact, no trade across that border. Also, Iranian-Azerbaijan relations have been strained because of the dispute. Russia has been sucked in. Pipelines routes have been affected. The fact that the quickest route for a pipeline from Azerbaijan would be through Armenia, it's gone all the way around via Georgia. The Russians have used it to strengthen their alliance with Armenia. The Azerbaijanis are trying to join NATO. So it's caused a kind of security headache for a much, much larger region, this very, very tiny conflict right at the centre of the Caucasus. I was absolutely fascinated by this project in Azerbaijan, which was called the Children's Republic, working in a small refugee camp in the plains of the centre of Azerbaijan, a very miserable place which was scorching hot in summer and freezing cold in winter, a sea of mud when the rains came down, a very inhospitable place where not very many people lived, but where thousands of refugees from the fighting had washed up. Azerbaijan still has hundreds of thousands of refugees because they were the big losers from the conflict when the Armenians extended their area of control outside Nagorno-Karabakh in the plains. The Armenians call it a buffer zone for their own security, and whatever the rights or wrongs of that claim, it resulted in a huge amount of human misery, all these tens of thousands of internally displaced people. And if you're a refugee and if you're living in a camp, it's very easy to fall into a kind of terrible passivity. You're waiting to go home, your life is on hold, you're reliant on handouts, you've lost work, you've lost initiative. And for children, this is obviously a terrible thing to grow up with. If you are a refugee for 10 or 15 years, that could be your whole childhood. And if you add to that the fact that these children and everyone there, particularly the children, were suffering from the effects of trauma of what they'd seen in the fighting, losing their homes, this really could threaten to blight a whole generation of children. What the psychologists did for this project was they decided to concentrate on the children and use four ways of sort of trying to empower the children again, give them back their lives, if you want. They use sport, drama, music, and art. And so there were, every weekend there would be these incredibly lively classes with football games going on, art classes, drama, and music, which gave these children some kind of purpose. The next step to do that was to found this thing called the Children's Republic, which was to elect a parliament, these children, where they would elect 10 or 12 people to be their parliament, to play at politics. They had their own newspaper, their own ministers. The Minister of the Environment would be in charge of the garden, the Minister of Culture would be in charge of the dance classes or something like that. And so this was a very impressive project, which was one of the very kind of rays of hope I saw in a very depressing situation after this war. And the psychologists were very pleased that they said that these children, even though they came from this desperately deprived background, when they went to competitions and they were up against other children competing in football matches or music competitions, the psychologists said that these children were very composed, very self-assured, and in some ways were more mature than children who had a much more privileged background. If Armenia had declared that Nagorno-Karabakh was part of Armenia formally to the international community, they would have a lot more problems on their hand. They would be seen to be formally occupying the territory of another state. So Armenia, the state, it's useful to say for them to say that the Armenians of Azerbaijan want to separate. We are sympathetic with them, but we don't recognize their separation. In fact, what's happened on the ground is that in Nagorno-Karabakh there's a road built by Armenians across from Armenia to Karabakh. They use the Armenian currency, they get Armenian money, the Karabakhis use Armenian passports. Armenians serve in the Karabakhi army, which it's hard to say if it's a Karabakh army or an Armenian army. They're so blended together. So it's a bit of playing with words there. Basically, Nagorno-Karabakh, although it's internationally on the territory of Azerbaijan, has become a province of Armenia. There has been a negotiating process from 1992, from the middle of the war, and some quite serious negotiators, and the USA, Russia and France are now the main negotiators on the conflict. So quite a serious negotiating process and various attempts, particularly in 2001, to bring the two sides together and to strike a deal. The problem is that the two positions are still so far apart that that actually almost no negotiator can bridge the gap. The only people who can really make a difference are the two sides by moving closer together. And yet both societies are still very, very much stuck in the fact that Nagorno-Karabakh is ours, that we justice and truth are on our side, and no compromise. And the leaders, although possibly they'd like a deal, for one thing, they grew up, their whole identity has been formed around this conflict. For another thing, it's politically risky to start to kind of try and go against society and trying to change society and talk about compromise, because that could weaken you in terms of domestic politics. And so the leaders are also stuck. They're too timid or too afraid or too comfortable to start talking about compromise, start changing the terms of the debate within societies. So in a sense, I think to talk about the negotiators is often a bit of a red herring. The negotiators, they come up with ideas, they come up with quite creative ideas sometimes, but the positions are simply too far apart. I think there is a shift of greater sympathy for Azerbaijan. As the years go by, people, obviously both sides suffered, but obviously as the years go by, the Armenians are more comfortable, and it's the Azerbaijanis who continue to suffer, particularly the refugees, and particularly with all this occupied territory. And whether that's right or not, whether that's because people have short historical memories or not, it does seem that the Azerbaijanis now draw more sympathy than they used to. And obviously the Azerbaijanis now have more powerful friends because of their oil reserves and of the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, which is opening up in 2005, which will give them huge oil revenues, particularly with the price of oil being so high. What difference does that make? Well, I think it makes Azerbaijan less compromising and more determined to stick to an uncompromising stance on Nagorno-Karabakh, so less inclined to make compromise. And I think it convinces the population that time is on their side. But I think in this, probably the ultimate result is it just puts back a peaceful settlement, because the Azerbaijan is less inclined to compromise, and the Armenians also think that time is on their side because they basically won the war and control the land, so they're waiting for the Azerbaijanis to come to them with concessions. I suppose the next question which arises is, will Azerbaijan try and use some of its billions in oil revenue to rearm and try and seek a military solution to reconquer the territories it's lost? Well, talking to military experts, they say the Azerbaijani army is still pretty weak. It's maybe now on the same level as the Armenians. But to retake that kind of territory militarily against a very well disciplined and very well defended enemy, which is what you've got in the Armenians who occupy all the high land, you would need a ratio of about between 3 and 5 to 1 in favour of the attacking forces. You would need huge amounts of weaponry, but also, most importantly, you need huge amounts of young men prepared to die for pretty much no reason in all the minefields around Nagorno-Karabakh. And you'd also need about 10 years to build up your army to make that possible. And you'd also need a government which was prepared to enrage international opinion, enrage the powerful Armenian lobby in America and France, worry the oil companies who have invested huge amounts of money in this region for the sake of a big oil pipeline. So, yes, there are lots of people in Azerbaijan who would like to spend that oil money on those kind of purposes, but I think it would be a disastrous route to go down. One can understand their frustration, but another war over Nagorno-Karabakh is the last thing anyone needs, to be honest.